I'm Jesse DeGroot, the marketing representative for the Mack Hayden Theater in Chatham, New York, and you're in tune to 90.7 FM WGXC Accra.
Network, this is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
You've tuned into All Together Now, WGXC's regional look at the news from Hudson Valley and the Capital Region, from the Catskills to the Berkshires and beyond. I'm Tom Rowe, and today you'll hear all sorts of local news updates, weather, interviews, and more, plus community events and the song of the day on All Together Now.
This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the news. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
On air, in air, waves controlled. On air, in air, channel connection. And the moon turns to blood.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Audrey Berman of Germantown, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Daily News. I'm Philip Grant. Sarah Tafton is reporting for Columbia Green Media. For a second time in less than a week, residents are learning of a spike in drug overdoses locally, this time in Greene County, according to Greener Pathways Program Director Carl Quinn. An overdose spike alert was issued for Columbia County April 6, followed by a similar alert for Greene County the following day. Greene County reported 6 overdoses, 3 of which occurred in one day. 6 non-fatal overdoses were reported in Columbia County since April 1st, with 4 happening over the weekend, Quinn said. And Rensselaer County Public Health Director Mary Fran Watchus also said there has been 8 overdoses there in the last 2 weeks. Quinn said, and I quote, "We normally have 2 to 3 overdoses a month in each county," end quote. The incidents were linked to heroin. Quinn said, and I quote, "Some required multiple doses of Narcan. It's probably a tainted batch strongly laced with fentanyl," end quote. In Columbia County, the overdoses occurred in the Chatham, Ghent, and Philmont areas, but the Greene County cases were more widespread. Quinn said the ODs are linked to the COVID-19 public health crisis. He said, and I quote, "We're hearing the drug supply is limited, which would be a good thing. Drug dealers are not able to be in transit. The supply has been interrupted. People may not be using the same reputable person they have been using in the past," end quote. The loss of traditional face-to-face group support meetings is a significant factor as well. Greener Pathways has been engaged in outreach in Northern Columbia County this week, as well as in Catskill. Quinn is hoping to set up locations in Cairo and on the mountaintop as well. The state's mental health hotline is 1-844-863-9314. And you can read this full story at HudsonValley360.com. MidHudsonNews.com is reporting JetBlue has announced it will suspend flights from New York Stewart International Airport in Newburgh and Westchester County in White Plains effective April 15th. All flights will be canceled through June 10th. JetBlue service at John F. Kennedy International Airport in New York will continue. The airline industry has been hard hit by the coronavirus pandemic, with many flights that are normally full going out all but empty. U.S. Representative Sean Patrick Mahoney last week flew from Westchester County Airport to Washington, D.C. He was one of only 3 passengers on board the flight. And you can read the full story at MidHudsonNews.com. And that wraps up the WGXC Daily News. For local weather reports, public meetings, COVID-19 updates, and other community information, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
Hello and welcome to the better weather. Get ready for the rain. A little before dawn, temperatures reach a low of 43, and then a little after dawn, the rain begins and continues through the day, almost until dark. At about 1 p.m., temperatures peak at 52 degrees. Chances of thunder are greatest, and rainfall rates begin to fall slowly till about 4 p.m. Overnight comes the fun. Thanks to our West Coast correspondent, Brian, we are aware of a potential bomb cyclone, which occurs when an extreme low pressure and rapidly strengthening storms form. Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your perspective, snow will be around. As temperatures bottom out in the mid-30s, just before dawn tomorrow, the system passes through, likely dropping a mix of snow and rain before vacating around 9 a.m. New England is going to get the brunt of it, with some sizable snowfalls predicted. The next high tides will be at 4:45 p.m. and tomorrow at 5:11 a.m. The next low tides will be at 11:07 a.m. and at 11:24 p.m. Water temperature will be 50 degrees. Sunset today will be at 7:10 p.m. and sunrise tomorrow will be at 6:23 a.m. Looking way up, we see three near-Earth objects are expected today. The largest is 162 meters wide, traveling at 18.6 kilometers per second. Should it actually collide with us, it would produce as much energy as the largest nuclear weapon on planet Earth. Researchers have reported the first detection of a jet emerging from two colliding galaxies, the first photographic proof that merging galaxies can produce jets of fast-moving charged particles. Solar wind speed is currently 419 kilometers per second at 2.4 protons per milliliter. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 3, quiet. There have been 4 days since the last sunspot, and this has been the Better Weather brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. I'm Philip Grant. Abby Huber is reporting for Columbia Green Media. Stay-at-home orders have been in place for nearly 3 weeks, and the city of Hudson is starting to feel the pinch. City Treasurer Heather Campbell said approximately 20% of the city's revenue, including parking, lodging tax, mortgage tax, building permits, and use of fund balance, are all expected to be affected by the ongoing COVID-19 emergency. The city's March 18th state of emergency temporarily suspended alternate side parking as well as the use of parking meters citywide, with the exception of the South Front Street lot across from the Amtrak station. In February, parking meter revenue fell by 43% from $10,500 in 2019 to $6,000 in 2020. Parking meter revenue fell to $6,500 for the month, a 48% decline. Parking ticket revenue continued to decline in March to $19,000, a 33% loss. If the stay-at-home order remains in effect through April and May, the city will take a bigger hit. While some building permits are being issued, on-site crews are smaller and non-essential construction is on hold. Campbell said property taxes, sale tax, and state revenue sharing will likely be negatively impacted by the emergency as well. And you can read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. Nick Reisman is reporting for State of Politics. Just about all New York voters on June 23rd will be able to receive an absentee ballot. Governor Andrew Cuomo's administration will move through an executive order to expand the reasons for accessing one. Cuomo made the announcement April 8th as elections commissioners in the state and lawmakers pushed to have the absentee ballot criteria expanded. The order is expected to expand the qualification criteria to include anyone who could contract coronavirus as a reason for receiving a ballot. Assemblymember Jeff Dinowitz backed the move. The Bronx Democrat said, and I quote, "As June 23rd rapidly approaches, I hope that local boards of elections quickly start to prepare to make it clear what they need to successfully operate all primary and special elections for Congress, the New York State legislature, political party positions, and any special elections. Nobody should be denied participation in our electoral process due to fear about personal or public health as a result of the coronavirus, end quote. And you can read the full story at NewYorkStateOfPolitics.com. Dennis Slattery is reporting for the New York Daily News. State Senator Michael Giannaris is asking Governor Andrew Cuomo to cancel rent for tenants and businesses whose finances have been affected by the coronavirus crisis. The Queens Democrat sent a letter to the governor April 8th. The governor has already suspended evictions for 90 days during the statewide stay-at-home order, but advocates and tenants say more needs to be done to prevent a flood of evictions once the crisis resolves. Giannaris proposed legislation 2 weeks ago that would allow, and I quote, any residential tenant or small business commercial tenant in the state that has lost income or has been forced to close their place of business, end quote, to have their rent suspended for 90 days. The measure would mean that renters or businesses would not owe anything during the three-month freeze, even when it's over. It would also mandate forgiveness of mortgage payments by landlords who face, and I quote, financial hardship, end quote, as a result of the rent cancellations. And you can read the full story in the New York Daily News. Eric Anderson is reporting for the Times Union. The U.S. Labor Department reported April 9th the number of new unemployment claims topped 6.6 million for the second week in a row. The filings reflect activity for the week ending April 4th. In New York State, more than 345,000 claims were filed, down from 367,000 the week before. During the past 3 weeks, 800,000 new claims were filed statewide. Nationally, that figure is more than 16 million during the past 3 weeks. Restaurants, retail shops, schools and colleges, and theaters and other venues have largely closed down, with only essential businesses continuing to operate as government officials urge consumers to stay home and practice social distancing. Airlines and Amtrak have cut service, with fewer planes and shorter trains operating. Regional highways are seeing lighter traffic even during rush hours. And you can read the full story in the Times Union. And that wraps up the WGXC Daily News. For local weather reports, public meetings, and other community information, including COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
Hello, this is WGXC 90.7 FM Accra. Do you read me?
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Gemini Construction, a full-service contracting firm specializing in complete electrical construction services. Gemini Construction, serving Greene and surrounding counties for over 40 years. For more information, contact 518-622-9829.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Jack Sensabaugh of Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Welcome, radio listeners. You're listening to Bound by Books Youth Radio on WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, and Hudson, listener-supported radio for open ears. I'm Emily. I'm the director of the Hudson Area Library, and I'm from Hudson.
I'm Amelia. I'm a student at Hudson High School, and I'm also from Hudson.
I'm AJ. I go to school at Libri, and I live in Elizaville.
And we're trying to get our friend Lena to join us, but we're having some technical difficulties, so she may join us in a little bit. But in the meantime, we're going to talk about some books, because that's what we do every week.
Books we love, books we hate, bookish things.
All that good stuff.
I'm sorry that I missed the last one. I also missed listening to it.
Well, luckily, you can listen to the radio show anytime on WGXC.org.
Yay!
Go to the audio archive.
Yay. So we're all recording today our show from our homes because the studios are temporarily closed and the library is temporarily closed. Lots of things are temporarily closed.
Most people think that their lives are temporarily closed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what have you all been up to this week?
Well, we just got a new swing set and our friend Louis just actually got to visit us and I've been reading as usual.
Yeah. The swing set's all set up? Mm-hmm. That's nice because the weather's been lovely some days. Most days.
A few days.
It's nice to be able to go outside when you can safely.
We have like 11 acres of land and we only use like 2 of them.
Wow.
It's funny.
Well, I guess if you get bored of those 2, you can expand.
Yeah, but the rest of it's all woods.
I used to play in the woods when I was a kid. I guess you just have to make sure it's safe in case there's like
ticks and hunters, or ticks.
Or monsters in the woods. How about you, Amelia? What have you been up to?
I finished The Tattooist of Auschwitz. I've been spending a shameful amount of time learning TikTok dances. And I have been continuing a weird series of collages I'm doing for art based off tarot cards.
Do you have a favorite tarot card you've made so far? Or artwork based on tarot cards?
Oh, geez. So far, my favorite one I've made is the first one I made, which was Death. Right now, I'm working on the Star, which I've been looking forward to making for a really long time.
I've been mostly working, but
what?
My job, because the library building is closed, but we're still offering programs and trying to get people access to resources. And so we're very busy, perhaps busier than when we're open.
Really?
Shocking. At least for me, it's a lot of work to shift your entire working life to remote work. But yeah, so in addition to work, I've had some nice Zoom calls with my friends and with my family. I did a couple game nights that were fun over Zoom. I played Codenames and Trivial Pursuit, and I won both games.
Yay!
My parents and I played Pandemic.
Oh no, did you save us?
We almost did, but then we always forget that when you run out of cards, you end the game.
So
we ended up waiting too long.
Yeah, I think I've played that game and most of the times we did not successfully save the world, or if we did, it was...
Almost in ruins?
No, it was... Sometimes we thought we won, but then realized we were playing wrong. And we're like, we won because we cheated.
I mean, the goal of the game is to cure all the diseases. You don't have to eradicate them, but I always forget that you don't have to eradicate them. So I'm like running around getting like these little cubes out of everywhere, and it's so strange. But I don't have to be doing that. And then by the time I realize I don't have to be doing that, all the cards are gone, and we are sad. I think I've only won the game once.
Yeah, I don't even know. Because I know there were times we won, but we didn't really win.
Can I share a book?
Sure.
What, you want to talk about books on a book show? What is wrong?
So sure. My book is The Sisters Grimm by Michael Buckley. I'll read the description. For the first time, sister parents were kidnapped. Sabrina and Daphne Grimm returned to their hometown, New York City, to find Puck's family. Puck is from A Midsummer Night's Dream. But the fairy tale detectives get more than they bargained for. The Big Apple, wand-wielding fairy godfathers, swashbuckling Wall Street pirates who wear suits and drink cocktails.
Fancy. Good for them. They're living their best life.
Subway-stealing dwarfs. And worst of all, hidden among all these urban ever-afters, a murderer. This isn't the city Sabrina remembers, the place where she spent happy normal days with her family. Even her memories of her parents aren't safe. As the sisters, Grimm, investigate the death of an important ever-after, they learn that their mother kept a secret from them that might lead to that evil organization, the Scarlet Hands.
So that's part of a series, right?
It's the fourth book. I only read the fourth book.
Was it okay jumping right in?
It's fine. I know what the characters were, and since there were some flashbacks, I can just make up what the story was, and hopefully it was accurate.
Do you want to know a fun fact?
Yes.
Before WGXC was on the air, thus before Bound by Books was a show, I did I think it was a pretend radio show, or it may have been like a radio show where it was broadcast just at Germantown Community Farm. I think that's what happened, where this young woman named Quinn, who was the original Bound by Books co-host of mine, and I talked about books on the show, and she talked about a book pretending that she was Barbie talking about a book for some reason. And she talked about that series.
Oh my gosh.
Fun fact.
That's funny.
So in a way, the first Bound by Books show ever, although it wasn't called Bound by Books and it wasn't on WGXE yet, was about that series. Huh. And it was co-hosted by me and Quinn, aka Barbie. Barbie, the original co-host.
If you're listening, then that's very nice.
It's so funny.
So what do you think of that series so far? Do you think you'll read more?
I want to get the fifth book, but because of the coronavirus, I know that I'm going to have to wait at least a day to get it. An extra day, because Wormley's out of all the packages.
I ordered a cute custom mask. You know, the kind of like the teeth on the outside with the pattern. And I need to wait a very long time for it to show up. And I'm very sad now.
And was it for the coronavirus or was it just for fun around the house?
Both. It has teeth on it. Of course it's going to be both.
I might wear it the rest of her life. Thanks. Yeah, one of my neighbors made a mask for me and my husband, so that was very nice.
Oh, my mom watched a video where it was on Facebook, I think, and it said that you can just cut up a bra and use the strap if it's not strapless for a mask. So it's like this part, and then you go put the strap around.
Yeah, I've seen some funny pictures on the internet of people with like a bra that perfectly fits their face and then like a larger bra that's taking up their whole face.
And there was also this one picture of a man with a paper shopping bag with two holes on his head, and my godfather also wore it. I am invincible.
My mom made me wear a mask when we went out walking, and I hated it. I just hate the way it feels.
Yeah, but it does feel
I should.
Odd.
Blech. I hate feeling your breath back on you. It's just weird.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's what I don't like about it. It's weird. I have not read a lot since finishing The Tattooist of Auschwitz, but I have listened to some story narrations online while I'm doing my art homework.
Cool.
So
where do you listen to them?
YouTube channels. I found there are quite a few that do scary stories. Sometimes they're, you know, creative writing scary stories. Other times they're actual true stories from people who have encountered like weird stuff. Like breaking and entering genres, all kinds of weird things that people have witnessed. There are a few channels that I really enjoy. Lazy Masquerade, Bebusta, Your Maker, and Mr. Creepypasta, who made that anthology that I talked about last time. But I've been listening to Mr. Creepypasta a lot.
I like that he's Mr. Creepypasta, not just Creepypasta. Very formal.
It's kind of funny. It is very formal.
It's formal, but it's funny. It's like, oh, you're Mr. Creepypasta.
He's a really good narrator, too. He can really, like, emphasize the story. And a lot of them are in first person, so that's, like, important. The one I'm reading right now was one that was originally written on a Reddit forum, I think, but I don't know which one, called Search and Rescue Stories. It's a very long series. Basically, this man starts out talking about his job as a search and rescue officer, and it starts out where you think that he really is a search and rescue officer, and he's just talking about the cases he's had that have gone wrong. So it starts out sounding like a very true story, but as he kept writing it, he began to add the weirder and weirder stuff. So now you like know it's a piece of fiction, it's creative writing, but you don't lose interest because it's very well done. So even when you get to the point where you know it's fake, you can like suspend your disbelief to be like, wow, this guy is seeing some really cool stuff and really creepy stuff. It has weird moments. It doesn't rely on gore too much, which I think a lot of these things do, unfortunately, but this one really doesn't, and it makes it a really good read.
Yay. I haven't been reading quite as much this week, although I've been listening to a book that I talked about on the show as one that I was planning to read, called We Ride Upon Sticks. Basically, there are two books that came out last month that feature field hockey teams. And I played field hockey in high school, so I decided I wanted to read both of the books. And one of them's a contemporary fiction novel, and the other is a historical speculative fiction novel, and that's the one I started with.
Emily, mm-hmm. What's contemporary?
Contemporary is like present day, realistic. So basically a book that feels like it could take place today in the real world. And then the historical one is set in 1989, and it's speculative fiction. Because it's about witches. I can read the description for you. It's so that one's called We Ride Upon Sticks by Quan Berry. And the intended audience was adults, but so far it reads like it could be of interest to teens as well. And the description goes, set in the coastal town of Danvers, Massachusetts, where the accusations began that led to the 1962 witch trials, We Ride Upon Sticks follows the 1989 Danvers High School Falcons field hockey team, will do anything to make it to the state finals, even if it means tapping into some devilishly dark powers. In chapters dense with 1980s iconography, from heathers to big hair, Berry expertly weaves together the individual and collective progress of this enchanted team as they storm their way through an unforgettable season. Helmed by good girl Captain Abby Putnam, a descendant of the infamous Salem accuser Ann Putnam, and her co-captain Jen Fiorenza, whose bleach blonde claw sees and knows all. The claw is her hair, by the way. The Falcons proved to be wily, original, and bold, flaunting society's stale notions of femininity in order to find their glorious true selves through the crucible of team sport and, more importantly, friendship.
Sounds interesting. I like it.
Yeah. So far it's fun.
Emily?
Yes, AJ?
You think I'll be able to read it? It sounds very interesting.
Possibly. I haven't finished it yet, so I don't know if it's age appropriate or not, because it is intended for adults. So I'll have to see by the time I get to the end if it feels like something that's right for you. But it's fun so far. I like it. And I grew up in the 80s, so I like all the 80s references. They have like a book that they write down all of their deeds that they do to like get their special field hockey powers. And the book is named Emilio Estevez because it's a notebook that has this actor that was popular in the 80s named Emilio Estevez. So they always talk about Emilio. I really want to see the hairstyle. I wish I had a picture of her with the claw. Mm. I want to know what that looks like. But yeah, so I've been listening to that. I also read one recently that's a picture book, but it's a nonfiction picture book that I thought was really cool, called The Next President, The Unexpected Beginnings and Unwritten Future of America's Presidents. It's by Kate Messner with Adam Rex. It's the illustrator. And it goes through the history of our country from the time that George Washington became president to present day, and then looking ahead to the future. And the way that it works, the timeline is really interesting, where it goes through each of the presidents, but it doesn't talk about each of them at the time that they were president. So they'll introduce George Washington and be like, when he became president, this many future presidents were already alive, and this is what they were doing.
Hmm.
And so when it introduces a president, the ones that are alive, some of them are in Congress, some of them are working some other job, some of them are teenagers, some of them are babies. So it's really interesting to think about like the passing of time and how many different backgrounds our presidents that we've had in the past have come from. So even though diversity has been low in many ways, they come from very different beginnings. You know, they've had many different careers that brought them to become president. And so it kind of leaves on this note of like, who are our future presidents? It could be like any number of people. And what are they doing now? Like,
that's interesting.
Like if Amelia was our future president, mm-hmm, right now she's on the radio.
Yep.
I'd vote for you, but I wouldn't blame you for not running. I wouldn't.
I would definitely run for president.
What would your platform be? Like, what would you want to change in our country or make happen?
Improve everything.
Every single thing?
Every single solitary thing that needs improving. And even if it doesn't need improvement, I'll make it even better.
Nice.
Okay.
Work with me. I got even better. Hey, yay. AJ, 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 go, yay.
All right, that was our special guest doll.
Her name is Riley.
Riley. Riley's on AJ's campaign team.
Yay!
Wow.
Oh, so I wanted to also mention our library is doing a fun challenge this month. We were supposed to have on Saturday, April 4th, we were supposed to have the Woke Baby Book Fair, but as you might imagine, we had to postpone that. So we're still hoping to offer it someday down the line. We just don't know when yet. But in the meantime, we're working with our curator in residence, Mahogany L. Brown, who is a poet who I read some poems from a book of hers last week. And so we're doing the Woke Baby Challenge this month. And so basically what we're doing is every Saturday, we're announcing a challenge that families and children can take part in during the week. And then the following Saturday, we announce the winners and we announce the next challenge. And they're all based on books from her Woke Baby book list and are just fun ways to get people creating and sharing and having fun. So our first Woke Baby Challenge that we're accepting submissions through Friday, April 10th, is to take or draw a picture that represents a rainbow to you. So people could draw a picture, they could take a photograph, they could like dress up in their most fabulous rainbow attire and take a picture and post it somewhere on social media and tag the library, tag Mahogany, and use hashtag Woke Baby Challenge. And then they get entered for some prize packs of books.
That's cool.
And so we thought it would just be a fun way to get people engaged and having fun doing some creative things. So that's our first challenge. And then we'll announce the next one on Saturday, April 11th, which is my dad's birthday.
Oh, happy birthday to Emily's dad.
Yay. He's great.
Yay.
I like that guy. Yeah, so feel free to check out our website if you go to hudsonarealibrary.org and look for curator in residence, Mahogany L. Brown, or Woke Baby Challenge. You'll find that info. We also have it on our social media pages, which is Hudson Area Library NY, because we're not the only Hudson Area Library in the world. True story. There's a lot of Hudsons.
How many?
I don't know, but enough that we're not the only one.
I'm like one more?
No, there's one
two?
There's more than that. I forget the number, but there's at least one in New Hampshire, Ohio, and I think was Wisconsin one. I forget. Every once in a while, people contact us about things that they think are happening at our library that are actually happening at a different Hudson area library. That's how I find out about them sometimes.
Funny.
Yeah. One idea, which I don't know if anyone's prepared for, but maybe you have something you can grab nearby. If not, but it's National Poetry Month in April.
Oh.
And I'm wondering if anyone has a favorite poem to share. Looks like AJ.
To Google Docs I go.
I have one.
Wonderful. Do you want to share?
Yes, it's about my adoption.
What's it called?
My Adoption.
Who's it by?
Me.
Oh, wonderful.
Adoption is like an angel answering someone's prayer. Adoption is what makes me me. Adoption is like being reborn.
That's really sweet. Did you write that just for fun or did you write that for school?
For school.
Yeah. Did your teacher or class give you any feedback on it? It's very nice.
They just read it and said, good job. And they sent home the paper and mom loved it. So she hung it up on the fridge.
Yeah, it's very sweet. Excellent work.
Thank you.
Did you find one, Amelia?
I'm attempting to. I don't actually know where they went. I really hope I didn't delete them. Otherwise, I'll be really sad.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a copy of them somewhere, but I don't know where those copies are. So it's not like they'd be lost, but
I can read one that I remember. We used to do poetry on the radio show a lot back in the early days, and I remember this as being one of Quinn's favorite poems. It's by Emily Dickinson. It's called I'm Nobody, Who Are You? I'm Nobody, Who Are You? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell, they'd banish us, you know. How dreary to be somebody, how public, like a frog, to tell your name the livelong day to an admiring bog. AJ did that one.
Yeah, because
I'm glad apparently I was the only one who wasn't aware that that was the thing that existed, but okay.
So
I found them. They were not lost.
Oh, good.
My classmate Sam had that because we were going to do a poetry recital, and so I basically remembered it all those times.
Yeah, it's a very nice poem. But now Amelia has one for us. Is this also one that you wrote, or is it a favorite?
Yeah, this is one that I wrote. I don't remember exactly the prompt, but I think it was I was given a bunch of random words and had to put them into a poem as a general theme. Because it's titled Random Word Poem, so I assume that was the prompt we were given. Her corporeal form sleeps beneath the tulip tree where they laid her to rest all those years ago. Her soul, however, dances up in the heavens. Up there she makes the shooting stars, weaving their comet tails. For others, they are beautiful, those incandescent wonders. For me, they are a torment, a reminder that she is no longer here. She is happier up there. She makes the night sky shine brighter, and the angels sing in rapturous joy when her creations take flight. It would be selfish of me to wish for her return and exchange her joy for my own, to bring her back to Earth and deprive the cosmos of her star showers.
That's very nice.
Nice.
I haven't written a poem in years, I guess since I was a kid.
Mm.
I can't remember if they had us write poems in high school. Maybe. I don't know. I can read another one. This is one I also remember reading with Quinn, actually. Because we used to try to read it all in one breath, which is a challenge. You have to read it really fast if you do it that way.
Yeah.
But it's
I can do the I'm nobody poem in a breath.
Oh yeah, we'll test you after. Okay, so this is called They Loved Paperclips by Lisa Jarno. All right, deep breath. Let's see. They loved harmony. They loved anthills. They loved food and cookies and harpoons. They loved the sound of laces of the shoes and snow. They loved the snow on Thursdays in the rain. And when they met, they loved that too. And igloos and the trees and things to mail and chlorine. And they loved the towels for the beach and hot dogs and the pool. And also when the wind rose up, they loved the ceiling and the tide. And then they loved the sky. And I took a number of breaths during that poem. I did not hurt myself. You have to read it really fast to do it in one breath.
Yeah.
Like, they loved harmony, they loved anthills, they loved food and cookies and harpoons, they loved the sound of laces of the shoes and snow, they loved the snow on Thursdays and the rain, and when they met, they loved that too, and igloos and the trees and things to mail and chlorine, and they loved the towels for the beach and hot dogs and the pool, and also when the wind rose up, they loved the ceiling and the tide, and then they loved the sky. That was one breath.
That's funny.
Can I just try to do the I'm Nobody one? I'm Nobody, Who Are You? By Emily Dickinson. I'm Nobody, Who Are You? Are You Nobody too? Then there's a pair of us, don't tell, they'll banish us, and you know how dread you be somebody out public like a frog to tell your neighbor look long day to an admiring bog. I did not take a pause there, I just stopped.
I like that to do it in one breath, you have to start really low.
I did not take a breath. I just paused. I was like, da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah, it's just funny. You started, I'm nobody, who are you? I'm nobody, who are you? And then eventually your voice got back to normal.
Oh, I forgot to tell you guys. I started writing I wrote my two short stories for this unit in creative writing. And it was a lot of fun.
What are they about?
Okay, so the first one, well, one, I'm going to say that my friends in English blackmailed me into titling it this. It's called Godfish, and I guess that fits. They say it fits. I don't think it does, but I'm awful at finding titles for my stories. About a marine biologist who always dreamed of being an astronomer or going into space instead of being a marine biologist. So one day he's invited on a trip to explore deep ocean with a bunch of other scientists and scuba divers, and he meets this fish that begins to tell him very strange things about space and how it knows about space, and now he can tell him everything he's ever wanted to know if he starts to throw his fellow sailors overboard when they don't suspect it. It's a horror story. My teacher really liked it. I'm pretty proud of it.
Yay.
It's definitely a story. And then the second one, which still doesn't have a title, but I'm thinking about titling it Identical, is about, oh, look at that. Someone's already edited it. I can't see the comments on my phone, but I guess I'll check that out later. This is the rough draft of this one. Mm-hmm. The final copy is not due yet. But the rough draft of this one is about two twin girls who have never met their father, but one of them is always told that she takes after her father. And it's said to be a very negative thing that she takes after her father. And she doesn't realize why until she reaches a certain age and realizes her father. There's like werewolf undertones, but I never call him a werewolf because I wanted it to be up to the imagination. Point is, he is like a form of transforming monster, and she is also a kind of transforming monster.
cool.
And then it just follows that whole narrative.
That's sort of
rough. When does she transform?
In my story, it says she did at the age of 3. The actual story isn't so much about her transformations, but more over something the mother does in order to try and make life better for the daughter that isn't a monster. But that would be like a spoiler if I were to say it. And I don't know if you guys would ever want to read it. So
that'd be fun.
I will not
read your stuff.
Spoil it.
I would want to.
So I know that in your creative writing class, you often get classmate feedback in mm-hmm. general. Is the way that you get feedback the same as it was when you were in school, or did you do it more in-person
no.
feedback?
When in school, the teacher would tape our work to several portions of the classroom, like on the walls and desks. And then we would have like a gallery walk is what she called it, where we would walk around, read the stories, and write down criticisms or things we liked about the story. But we obviously can't do that now. Yeah. So we are told to email it to the teacher and two other students. I kind of missed the way we did it before because I liked seeing everyone's comments rather than just two, but it's the best we can do.
Maybe if you have any that are short enough that we could read on the radio sometime, maybe you could read a favorite super short story.
Well, both of the ones I just talked about had the requirements of being above 1,000 words, mm-hmm. but neither of them breached 2,000 words. I don't know how that goes as reading length is regarded,
yeah.
but I do have microfictions that are below 1,000 or 500 words. Those could be more suited to radio.
Yeah, maybe we can hear one in a future week. Maybe yeah. AJ has some other writing to share too. I could see if I have any old embarrassing stories from when I was younger that I wrote. Probably not nearly as good as anything you all write.
That'd the one microfiction that I would love to read on the radio maybe is also in the genre of horror because that seems to be my scary. Niche. Yeah.
Yeah, well, we'll have that to look forward to on a future show. But yay. We should wrap up, say goodbye for this week. Thank you to everyone out there listening. Hope everyone is well. Staying safe and healthy and entertained and engaged and reading lots of books.
Yay.
Have a good week and happy reading.
See you guys.
The Public News Service DOI Newscast for April the 9th, 2020. I'm Mike Clifford. The New York Times reporting Sanders concluded a quest that elevated him as a standard-bearer of American liberalism, clearing the way for a general election battle between the presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden and President Trump at a time of national crisis. The Times' Cindy Ember captured the moment this way. In a live stream speech, Sanders, eloquent but without his characteristic spark, cast his decision in the broader context of the fight against the coronavirus. Quoting Sanders, "I cannot in good conscience continue to mount a campaign that cannot win and which would interfere with the important work required of all of us in this difficult hour." Wisconsin, among a handful of states where racial data is being used as part of tracking COVID-19 cases, Mike Moen reports for PNS, the information shows the pandemic is ravaging black communities in places such as Milwaukee.
Health officials say black residents make up almost half of the nearly 1,500 cases so far in Milwaukee County and more than 70% of all deaths related to the virus. Pat McManus of the Black Health Coalition of Wisconsin says it reflects years of neglect by local and state health officials when it comes to outreach and resources. She says with the pandemic, the information they do receive isn't always helpful.
For example, but call your private physician. Now, I can guarantee you that well over 50 or 60% of the people in my community do not have a private physician.
McManus says the lack of proper outreach is harmful since many people living in black communities struggle with chronic health issues. Local health officials say they're trying to be more transparent and responsive to these concerns, pointing to the inclusion of racial data in the pandemic reporting. Last year, both the city and county passed resolutions declaring racism as a public health crisis and the need to address racial bias in decision-making.
On a national scale, advocates are calling on the CDC to include racial information when reporting cases. And at-home caregivers are looking after the people most vulnerable to COVID-19 and need more protective gear to do their job. More on that from Eric Tegetoff.
President of the Caregivers Union, SEIU 775, Sterling Harders, says that this week, Washington State agreed to put in-home caregivers, who are deemed essential workers, on the priority list for personal protective equipment. but they can only receive PPE if they're caring for someone who is showing signs or has tested positive for coronavirus. Harder says it's a great first step, but it's not enough.
Caregivers are leaving their homes every day. They're taking care of their clients. They're taking them shopping. They're taking them to doctor's appointments. And it is not fair to expect caregivers to do that work and not give them the equipment that they need to do it safely.
This is PMS. Renters in the United States tend to have lower incomes and less stable jobs than homeowners, creating greater anxiety for them during the current health crisis, but there are resources to help.
Lauren Pena with the Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada helped author a toolkit for renters, which explains their legal rights, specifically regarding the coronavirus pandemic. She says the governor's emergency housing directive suspends most evictions and covers those who lease single-family homes and any other rentals.
That applies to people living in weeklies. That applies to people living in apartments. And this suspension is going to last until the state of emergency is lifted by the governor.
The coronavirus pandemic has caused mass layoffs and other financial hardships. I'm Roz Brown.
Previous studies have shown that at least 45% of renters say they do not have enough in a savings account to cover a single month's rent payment. The Legal Aid Center Toolkit for Renters is available at lascn.org. Some experts are now warning that chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, recently authorized by the FDA to treat COVID-19, can trigger serious psychiatric effects. Dr. Remington Nevin is a physician, epidemiologist, and faculty associate in the Department of Mental Health at Johns Hopkins University.
If we are going to proceed down this road, at the very least, we should ensure the public is aware of the drug's dangers. Use of this drug on a wide scale will result in an increase in mental illness in the population.
Dr. Nevin says studies have shown that in some people, the drugs can trigger a range of neurological side effects, including psychosis, depression, paranoia, and anxiety. He believes mental health disorders potentially could skyrocket if large segments of the population begin taking the drugs. For his part, President Trump consistently has made statements supporting use of the drugs for treating people infected with the new coronavirus. And finally, conservationists accusing federal officials of using the coronavirus as a smokescreen to issue controversial rules on public lands across the West. A study by the Center for Western Priorities found that the Interior Department has issued 57 separate actions since March the 6th. That's when President Trump signed the first COVID-19 emergency bill. Eric Movar is with the Western Watersheds Project. He says Interior released the Great Basin Fuel Breaks Project last week. It orders the destruction of thousands of acres of sage-grouse habitat.
During extreme fire weather, these fuel breaks don't mean anything. It's foolish to think that clearing a fuel break actually does anything.
Movar believes the real purpose of clearing the land is to provide more acres for ranchers to graze their livestock. Federal officials say they're following all applicable notification and public comment rules in issuing those new regulations. My daily reminder, 6 feet of separation keeps all of us safe. This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service. We are member and listener supported and online at publicnewsservice.org.
We're talking with Richard Brooks, who is coordinator for 350.org around divestment and the fossil-free campaign throughout North America. Recently, 350 and Divest New York put out a news release announcing that the campaign has actually managed to get half of the New York State senators to sponsor the bill to divest the state pension fund from fossil fuels. So Richard, why is this an important step?
Well, this is an important step because with a majority of senators at the state level, we can get the bill, the Fossil Fuel Divestment Act, to a floor vote. And with the majority in support, that bill would pass. Now our work is turning to the assembly, where we have about 50 assembly members who are sponsors of the bill. We are hoping to get to a clear Democratic majority there as well in the next couple of months. And then the bill will be set up for a successful vote across both houses, and can hopefully be put into law, passed into law.
Now, I understand that 350 put out a report recently showing that just a handful of companies, I believe maybe perhaps invest in tar sands and perhaps fracking, actually has shown a major loss in value in terms of the state pension.
Yes, we put out a report a couple of weeks ago, and the reason for putting out this report was to bolster the financial argument of why it's important to move ahead with divestment. With the New York State Comptroller unwilling to budge on shedding or divesting from fossil fuel stocks, and that includes coal stocks, oil, and gas stocks, that's why we've gone to the legislators and are supporting this, or pushing this bill to move forward, because the comptroller has been unwilling to act. One of the strongest arguments that we have, beyond the moral arguments of not wanting to invest in companies destroying our future, is that the staying invested in the energy sector, in particular fossil fuel companies, is a losing proposition. There's very little money to be made in this sector, and in fact, the pension funds of over a million New Yorkers are at risk because of staying invested in this sector. So we took a little snapshot look at how some of the stocks are performing, and it was quite revealing and unfortunately quite depressing as well. So we looked at 16 tar sands companies and fracking companies. These are some of the most egregious subsectors of the energy sector. And we found that the New York Common Retirement Fund has suffered a $1.5 billion loss in the last year by staying invested in these companies. So an original investment of about $2.3 billion has now dropped to below $900 million. And so it's a pretty significant decrease, a 60% drop in value. And what was also interesting that we found out is that the drop wasn't just due to the stock market crash in the last month, or even the crash in oil prices that's happened over the last 4 or 5 weeks, due to the kind of price war, as they're calling it, between Saudi Arabia and Russia. A lot of the loss was baked in before the coronavirus decimated economies around the world and before the oil price crash. And that's in contrast to the rest of the stock market and how other industries have been performing. Other industries have been hitting new highs in terms of their value. But when it comes to the energy sector, we've seen multiple year decrease in value, and that's quite significant. And so if the pension fund is holding 7 or 8% of its total assets in fossil fuel companies, that equates to a pretty significant loss and pretty significant and avoidable impact on the pension fund and the value of its total holdings.
One of the companies I noticed was Exxon, which at a couple of years ago, the state had, actually about $1 billion invested in Exxon, even as the Attorney General was bringing litigation against them for lying about the reality of climate change. And that value is now actually dropped by $500 million, $500 million. But since 350 started this campaign to divest, I think 5-6 years ago, how successful has it been in other parts of the country and world?
Well, the divestment movement has been wildly successful. Some people have described it as one of the most successful movements of all time in terms of the victories we've been able to chalk up across the board and the speed at which the campaign has been able to achieve success. So At this point, we're at more than 1,100 institutions with assets over $14 trillion who have made commitments to divest from fossil fuels. And that includes more than 300 pension funds and some type of city or state governments, national governments even, have made commitments to divest. That's a pretty significant amount. We know that in New York State, New York City has already is basically halfway through implementing their commitment to divest from fossil fuels. Norway and their sovereign wealth fund have divested some of the assets that we actually studied in this analysis that we did of the New York State's holdings. So some of the tar sands companies they've divested from and others. So when you have institutions like that who are able to move forward on divestment and do so in a fiduciary responsible way, it really begs the question as to why New York State is not doing the same. And it's for that reason that we're pushing as hard as we can to get the Fossil Fuel Divestment Act voted on, gathering sponsors on it, and moving it forward, because there are no excuses anymore, and there's obviously mounting evidence that it makes sense from a financial standpoint. It certainly makes sense from a climate standpoint to divest New York State and its pension funds from fossil fuels.
We are talking with Richard Brooks from 350.org. I know most of the state legislators, I should say Democratic state legislators in the Capital District, have signed on to the legislation, the big exception being Assemblymember Santa Barbara out there in the Schenectady area. He's actually on the committee which the bill goes through. He has refused so far to sign on to the bill. And I know that some of the local groups, Extinction Rebellion, you know, had a little sit-in at the state controller's office, last month, to protest his lack of action. But what can the average person do at this moment to help promote the divestment campaign?
Sure, there's lots of things that people can do. And, there's a full toolbox that we can use at our disposal. You know, with coronavirus, it's a little bit more challenging to do things in groups. But there's many things that people can do from their homes that would be helpful in terms of moving the issue forward. I think the most important thing is to call one's legislator up, be they in the Assembly, be they in the Senate. If they're not a sponsor, urging them to become a sponsor of the Fossil Fuel Divestment Act is kind of step number one. And if they already are a sponsor of the Act, is to ask them to push their colleagues who are not yet sponsors to sign up to the bill as well. I think that's the most important thing. So emailing them, calling them, going on social media, their Facebook pages, on Twitter, and sending messages to them, that's a key step that everybody can do.
Richard, we have about a minute left. What's going on with the XL pipeline? That thing seems to rise from the dead like a vampire.
Yes, and it's unfortunately risen again. And what we've seen with the fossil fuel industry time and time again is that they use crises to push forward their agendas and their business proposals. And Keystone XL is a great example. So under the cover of the global pandemic, where everybody is saying, you know, have to stay home, you can't protest, you can't gather people up to move issues forward. TC Energy, formerly known as TransCanada Energy, the company behind the Keystone XL pipeline, has moved ahead with beginning construction of Keystone, basically under the cover of the global pandemic. They are beginning to move supplies into Montana and building out man camps, and they are planning on bringing in hundreds, if not thousands, of workers from out of state to begin construction of the pipeline. This puts rural communities and indigenous communities who have already strained healthcare systems really at risk. And we and others are condemning this development. You know, it's one thing to be moving ahead with construction if you've got permits during a normal situation, but using a pandemic to push forward with clearly non-essential construction is horrendous, and doing so and putting people's lives at risk is makes it even more awful.
Richard, we're out of time. We've been talking with Richard Brooks, North America campaigner for 350.org on divestment and fossil free. And you've been listening to Mark Dunley on Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Here is what you can do to help during the COVID-19 outbreak locally. The American Red Cross is warning of a blood shortage. The organization says fear of spreading the coronavirus prompted the cancellation of blood drives around the country, bringing the blood supply to dangerously low levels. The organization is urging those who can to donate blood and have provided a list of the precautions the Red Cross is taking to keep donors healthy at redcrossblood.org. Right now, there is a critical shortage of type O blood. Anyone who can should go to redcrossblood.org to see about details about donating blood locally.